Cool. I've been working on the next async testing video.
Yeah.
It's tough. Who knew async testing is tough?
Two hard categories, async and testing.
That's so true.
You know, combine them, they should cancel each other out.
Yeah, exactly. All I can say is I think we take for granted how much Ember does for us out of the box when it comes to this stuff.
What is the scenario that you're kind of setting up and testing in the video?
The scenario is we have this bar chart component that we made for the D3 series, and we want to test it. And I want to make like component tests for this thing. But the tricky thing is that it transitions, so it takes time. And that's where all the problems begin.
So what, I get, so the thing transitions. So what if you like, you write a test for it, you'll start running your assertions while like the component is calculating and changing like height of the chart.
Exactly. So where to begin? Like, transitions complicate testing because, kind of as we've been talking about in the series, anything that takes time, your test harness has to be aware of. So if you think about like testing a function that just runs synchronously, it's really easy to think about because the program just runs from beginning to end, right? But then you introduce asynchronicity or asynchrony. Can we just agree as a community which one it is, by the way?
Async.
Async. Once you introduce async, no, but you need to be an async function or the noun version. Once you introduce asyncness, let's go with that. Now you're like out of band. And like, it's interesting to think, remember we used to talk about when we were learning about Node and stuff, like where that like set timeout is not actually part of JavaScript.
Yeah.
It's like not a JavaScript language feature.
Right. It's like a run loop thing.
It's like a
event loop.
Yeah, exactly. Set timeout, set interval. I don't even know how like the callback. How do the callbacks work with like jQuery Ajax and stuff? I guess XML HTTP request is also a browser API, not a JavaScript one.
Right.
So basically, anything that interacts with the event loop introduces problems because you're running a test and you've finished your program, but you need to wait for something to happen later. So the question then becomes, how do you know when that thing is done? How do you even know if something has been scheduled? What if something could be scheduled or maybe not? What if you render a chart and by the time your render method has finished, like we have a bar chart component, which we have a render method on, that's idempotent. So you can kind of rerun it over and over again and whatever the data is, it'll be correct. But let's say you happen to go from like one bar of height of data point 8 to one bar of data point 16 and it animates up or something like that. Well, let's say you have a 500 millisecond delay on it, and so now you have a delay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the way Ember testing works here is they check the queue. They check the run later queue. And if there's anything in that queue, they know to wait.
Right.
So, I with a JavaScript, I don't think you can get insight into like what timers are currently queued up.
Right.
So how do you know? I think you need some sort of abstraction that wraps set timeout or set interval where you can log these things and you can say, okay, something was queued up. And you know, this is what run later does.
Exactly. So the run loop is exactly the solution to this problem. But when it comes to things like you're writing your own code in D3, let's say D3 has its own timer system. It has timers and it has a way to flush those timers and all that stuff. So
is there an API that's like pending timers?
No, there's an API to flush timers, but there's no API for checking like the global timer. I don't even know if there is a global list of timers where you can just say, are there any timers that have been scheduled? So I'm still working on this, but kind of you go down this path where you start doing this yourself, where within the bar chart component, maybe you want to, let's just say you have a bar chart and you want to yield out is animating property. So the bar chart component renders the bar chart, but it also has this animating property, or maybe it emits an action like on animation change, and it can be true or false. And that way you can know, the rest of the world can know. You could like block a route transition on this. You could do all sorts of stuff with it. Pretty cool, right? But you have to kind of implement this yourself. So that's kind of what I'm doing.
So in your D3 code, you like fire like on animating start, do the animation, and then when it ends, you fire something else. Or like you yield a property that's like is animating and it's true when you start and it's false when you end.
Exactly. It turns out to be a little tricky because let's say you have a bar chart and you the way you write D3 is like you pass an array of like 10 elements and you have a bar for each one of those. And with D3 selections, you select all of those bars and you bind the data and then you animate each one. But the way you write D3 is like declaratively per bar. So you're thinking like, this bar starts at a height of 0, animate it to its scaled height based on the data point, animate the opacity from 0 to 1. And so D3 and its timers are going to actually kick off like 10 different animations. Mm. So if you were to just say like on end, you'd get like 10 different things. So now you need to actually keep track of how many animations are running. That's kind of what I did. It was actually pretty simple. You just, every time you start animating, you increment active animations, let's say it's just a number.
Yep.
And then every time on end fires, you decrement them. And if it's 0, there's nothing left that's animating.
So this is interesting because this is how Ember testing works with AJAX requests. You know, if there's a pending AJAX request, then basically the test runner pauses because you're probably, you know, you might have a model in flight or you might be loading data. So it's not going to go on to the next step. And the way it does this is that there's like a pre-filter, pre-flight hook.
So it basically knows in the sync run of the initial program, something's been scheduled.
Yeah. And so it increments like AJAX, pending AJAX request, plus, plus. And then when it comes back, it's minus, minus. And it knows it can continue on to the next step when that number is 0.
So interesting. The thing that I'm running into right now is, okay, so you have this thing that keeps track of the number of active transitions, and when it goes to 0, you know, you're good. If you were to just render me a bar chart and it has a transition, it's easy to conceptually think, okay, I'm going to say within my bar chart on that initial render, active transitions is 1, and then once there's an end, make it back down to 0, and then you can fire off like an animation did end event or action, right? That's conceptually simple. Where it gets hard is the way D3, you add a handler to the start when you know something started. So what if there is no transition? This is the thing. Let's just say there's no you render the chart and there's nothing there. And so the start event of the bar never gets fired. And so if you were to just increment a transition, let's say active transitions is 1, but the end event never fires because there is no transition on this render.
Is there a way that like the end event can always fire even if there's no?
How would you know? Because it's not firing an end event because there is no transition.
Well then, okay. So this is like, if there is no transition, then it wouldn't fire a start event either.
Right. So this is the problem though. If I put active transitions plus plus in the start event, then on that first render of the sync program execution, by the end of that program, active transitions is 0. So the test is not going to know to wait unless you were to like go to the next tick, force it to. But if you just, the nice thing about, okay, so the AJAX.
Wait, but isn't that okay? Because JavaScript is synchronous.
Right, but think about the AJAX case. You run the synchronous program, and as part of that synchronous program, you did an AJAX call, and that added something to the pending timers. And you know when it comes back, you're going to be able to decrement it.
Yep.
So that's the thing. You need to know. You basically, on that first run, need to assume there is going to be something asynchronous happening. And then what I need now is a way to say when my bar chart has finished, somehow like check the next tick and make sure nothing asynchronous was scheduled. But there's no event that's going to fire. You see what I'm saying?
No.
Let's say you run that AJAX method and you increment pending timers. When do you decrement the pending timers? When the AJAX responds. But what if the AJAX doesn't respond? then somehow. What if there was an error and it never went out or something? I guess you'd catch the error and be able to decrement it, right? There's always a way to like say it's finished.
Yeah. What, I mean, there could be a pending AJAX request that just takes 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like extreme edge.
But that's.
But that's why you have like test
timeout. Yeah, yeah, totally. No, but the trickier case is like there's a situation where because the actual rendering of a bar chart has the possibility of queuing up asynchronous work, you need to be able to flush that asynchronous work, flush the list that's keeping track of it. And I can do that when there is a transition. But if there's not, we need a way to say, because you don't know. That's the whole point. You see what I'm saying? The whole point is at the end of that render method, how would you know whether there's asynchronous work or not? How would you know?
Well, the idea is if there was asynchronous work, something inside of that render method,
yes,
would have incremented a counter.
Something inside the render method can add an event handler to the transition start event. But if that never fires.
Yeah, so if we get to the end of the method and that.
No, but if you only increment it in on start, the thing is on start doesn't fire until the next tick.
I see.
So that's why in the initial sync run of the method, you have to say, you know what, since we can't know for now.
I see what you're saying now. Okay. So I think just coming into this, bad ideas. Can you do something where you put something ember.run .schedule next? Schedule in the next.
That's actually a good idea. I hadn't actually thought about that.
And then say like, okay, so I've gotten to the end of my render method because
I will know by the next tick.
Because transition start hasn't fired because I'm just in sync land.
Yep.
Yeah. By the next tick, I will know. So, exactly. So I put something on that's like, just no matter what,
and then by the next tick, you know. But this way, from the caller's perspective, the bar chart will fire an on animation start. This is kind of weird, right? Because now you have, it's kind of weird, but it's fine. You have an on animation start, like is animating from the perspective of the caller is true as soon as you render it, and then it will be false the next tick. I think it's fine.
Do you even need to do that? Like, can you have like two things? You have like is checking for potential animation true, and while that's
true. But then the
true,
test waiter is going to have to say, either you're checking for
potential. You basically have two test waiters here.
But like what?
Because you don't want to make an API in your bar chart that's like is animating true, and then it next tick is animating false, and the thing was never animating.
What's the difference between is animating and is checking for animation? The point is it's asynchronous thing that's like blocking the completion. Basically, it hasn't finished rendering. That's what you want to know.
Okay.
So finished rendering is basically you're saying, you can only be guaranteed you're finished rendering on the next second tick. Yeah. But it seems weird. It seems like if D3 had better way, it's just weird.
Is there also like, is there a way that you can, there's like different queues that the browser has, you know how like promises, even if you just resolve a promise, you do new promise and it takes a resolve function and then you call resolve one, resolve true.
Yep.
That thing is async.
It will do on the next tick.
It will do on the next tick.
Because the interface of promise resolve is next
like
tick.
The A plus spec is.
Yeah.
Is there like a way that you can, just some API, like something like that you can abuse in this situation where you're just like.
Maybe that's okay. I mean, maybe that's like is the interface and like
every chart.
Rendering is async. Even if you render a static template, it's like you have to assume it's async. That's just the interface. So maybe it's fine.
Yep.
Cool. I'm going to try that.
Nice.
So to explain, kind of put in context what we're talking about in the series is asynchronous testing. We walk through, if you go to the Ember Test Helpers repository, those docs haven't made it into the main guides yet. So you have to, but there's a note at the end, at the top of the API docs that will get you there. And they talk about all the testing helpers and stuff. And it's really great since like the testing unification stuff has landed. Like one way to do it all in component tests is really awesome.
Yep.
And the waiters are basically, they're something that have been very well abstracted away because I haven't had to really concern myself with them for years of Ember development. you do if you get into these nitty gritty details, but by and large, it's taken care of for you. So it's pretty cool just to realize how complex this problem is and how much Ember does for us. So the series walks through the things like wait for, which is when the DOM is being changed and you need to wait for something to change there, but Ember doesn't know about it. Ember knows about a few things. Let me just go over them and see if I can remember, because I know you'll remember all of them. The pending timers is the AJAX, the network request, basically. Well, certain network requests made with, actually, I don't know. It's a good question. I think it's XML HTTP request. I think you could actually just new that up and use that, and it would add to a timer.
Really?
Maybe.
I was going to say, I would say my guess here is no.
Okay.
My guess here would be like a hook in a jQuery, because I know Ember fetch, basically monkey patches fetch and increments a counter when you.
Right. So the fetch doesn't work out of the box, the global fetch.
Right.
So you might be right there. Yep. It's
Ember fetch. Basically Ember fetch is like it wraps fetch.
Right. Right.
With this timer thing.
Right.
Count thing.
Right. But basically it's for exactly the same reasons we just discussed, which is you have to know when something's scheduled or not. And so the pending timers is one of them for network requests that it's aware of. Anything on the run loop. So as Ember, right?
Close.
Anything, there's a certain queue of the run loop or?
I think it looks for like run later stuff. Things are scheduled on a run loop.
Yeah.
So I think if you have a run loop.
Because anything else is going to happen sync.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But I think if you just like you start a new run loop, I mean, it would run synchronously.
Right. But like run next or run later.
Those would schedule
and they would increment. And yep. So that settled state would be not settled yet.
There's some internal data structure, like an array of things that need to run later.
Right.
And that thing would not be not zero.
Right.
And then the test would wait.
And then the third thing is a test waiters. So is the test helpers, like visit and pause and click and stuff like that. So those are... right. Or actually those are promises now. Yeah. So you just await them.
Yep.
Yeah. Right.
There's another thing. There's a third one.
What is the third one? Wait,
you'll get it.
Timers, run loop timers, network requests. Wait, did we talk about this in the series? No.
No.
What is it? I did talk about it in the first video, but I can't remember.
Route transitions.
Oh yeah. That's what I was thinking with the visit. Yeah. Yeah. So, right.
Cause route transitions are async. You have your before model, your after model hook.
Right.
So while those things are running,
even if those things don't use AJAX, because normally we think of like a route.
Right. Yes.
So exactly. You can return if you just kick off a promise in your code, the test is not going to wait for any arbitrary promise that is created in your code. But if you return a promise, whether or not it uses AJAX, if it's just a promise, they use a set timeout to resolve it 5 seconds later, and you visit that route, the test will know to wait because the test knows that those hooks are async aware. So that's what it will automatically wait for.
And it is amazing with just those checks we just mentioned.
Yeah. You cover 95% of async code in your program.
You can go a year of writing all sorts of tests in Ember and not even thinking about these things.
Yeah.
And I often think about sort of like the Rails Capybara UI testing where it's there's no global waiters. Mm-hmm. You basically do something and then you define your very next line would be like what you wait for. Mm-hmm. So if you were doing a route transition, you would say like click the blog post link and then wait for like an H1 with a blog post title to show up.
Right.
So there's no, is magic the right word? I don't know. But the Ember, I mean, the point is it's amazing how far the Ember stuff gets you.
Yes.
And you would think like, yeah, it leaks. It leaks sometimes, which is what this whole series is about.
Right.
But it's super impressive.
Right. And even when it leaks, it's really actually done an exceptionally good job here of giving you the low level escape patches. This is a great example where like the high level stuff gets you very far. But then when you run into a problem, when you're using D3 that has its own custom timer setup, obviously Ember's not going to be aware of that. You have the tools you need to build this stuff. So that's what the series does. It goes through... wait for, which is what you just described, which is an arbitrary way to wait for anything that's happening in the DOM. So if you expect something to happen, you can wait for it. And then we're talking about wait until in this next video, which is function, waiting until a function returns true. So that lets you do anything like this. Is animating, wait until is animating is false to make an assertion against the thing. It's pretty cool because then you can like render your bar chart with an array of values, wait until is animating is false, assert what the chart looks like. And then you just call set on the array and you just change the number. And then like your bar chart just starts kicking off again because your bar chart is knows to respond to changing data. And then you just say, wait until it's done animating, which is like exactly how you would think about it if you were looking at the UI.
Yeah.
Super awesome.
Yeah, right. You wouldn't say change this data, then immediately assert. You'd say change it. I mean, think about it. Even if you were like testing with like a mouse and a keyboard and things were animating, you'd like kind of take your hands away and be like, okay, I'm going to wait for it to finish. And then
Very cool. So it's really neat. Basically, you're being able to test the intermediate states. And like if once you get it, it's just as easy as all the other ways of testing. I think before, like if I've ever added like CSS animations to my Ember app and then you run the tests, like the CSS animations don't affect the test. So you have like visit homepage, click this and the modal fades in and you click the button, but your test just runs through it super quick.
Right.
But if you look at it, you see like the animation's trying to start, but then it just keeps going.
But the button is available as soon as the animation starts. So from a test point of view, it can click the button.
Exactly.
But it's not
really testing.
Because it's not how a user would use it.
Yeah, exactly. So what you want is you do want the test to wait for those things. And then you want to adjust the duration of the animations in the test. Because you don't want the test to take 2 seconds, but you do want to have it potentially take 2 seconds. Like you want to be able to run it in a mode that's like real time. And then you want to condense the time by either moving time forward, which there's a great Dockyard blog post about this that I was looking at that talked about using some fake like tools from Sinon.
Like a fake clock.
Yeah. It's called like Lumix. It's called something like that. And it basically lets you like jump forward 3 seconds. So then the test, you can say like set duration of 3 seconds. Render the thing, jump forward 1.5 seconds and make an assertion that my animation's half done. Mm. And then jump forward the rest and make sure the end state is correct.
Nice.
Pretty awesome. And then you can like, so the test will be super fast, but if you wanted to, you could see that thing happen in real time.
So you can change the clock and the animations will also like catch up to the change in clock.
Good question.
Ruby has a good gem. Question. Ruby has a gem called Time Cop.
Yep. I've used that.
Yeah, and I love that.
Yep.
For like, you know, testing that someone's account is active for 30 days.
Right.
And it just makes it so, so easy.
Totally. Yeah, this stuff is super cool. So that's my next step. I want to get the thing working in real time and then know like, hey, this is how we test the intermediate states. This is pretty awesome. But like, we don't want our test to take 2 seconds just because we want to test the intermediate states of a 2 second animation. So then the question is like how best to speed it up.
That's really cool. That's like, I definitely look forward to that because I don't want to just hear a lecture about how I should make my tests take 0.001 seconds in animation. Like I actually want to see how you develop it. And yeah, the way you develop it is like
first getting it working in real time.
Yeah. And then speeding it.
Yes, totally.
Awesome.
You know, like, Liquid Fire does a great job of this where out of the box, it's going to work in your tests, even though it's doing all sorts of animations and stuff like route transitions as well, because that makes sense. They hook into the promise like we talked about. But this is where CSS animations are really cool. But ideally, you do want them hooked in this way. And I think we might in this series explore that, making it so that because CSS animations, even though, like we said, they don't affect the content on the page, so the clickable elements and stuff are programmatically accessible. So Ember can continue on. If you wanted to make it do this, the browser has events that it fires that says animation end.
Yep.
So I think that's what you would actually want to do.
I've also heard people say that they want like intermediate states.
Yeah.
While animations are happening.
Yep.
So you actually don't want your button to be clickable because now all of a sudden you have this button flying across the screen and it's interactive.
Right.
And that makes no sense.
Right. Totally.
So.
Right. 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 The user cannot be able to do that unless they're like Jedi mouse ninjas. Totally. That's a really, there's something where you could say like you could have a global waiter that says you can't interact with the page until all animations are finished.
Yeah.
And that's what we're going to get at in the last video of the series, is the global, registering a global waiter. Because right now the test has to say, all right, I'm rendering a bar chart component. Let me wait until it's done animating. But then you can do a thing where basically you make it so that in the same way that tests don't have to say, wait until the network request is done, the D3 bar chart will automatically force the test to wait whenever it's animating. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty neat. So that should be coming out soon, probably this week. Hooks. We were messing around with hooks this week.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Very cool.
Algebraic effects. Everyone feels so much smarter right now. Right. So what are hooks?
Hooks are our React's new system for having pure components that are pure functions that can be run over and over and over again, and you don't have to worry about the state of that component interfering with running the component over and over and over again. So we often think about like our handlebars templates, you can just render them. You don't really think about when they render or when they re-render. Conceptually, you can say like, oh, they re-render when things change. But the idea is we don't have like side effects in our template. We sort of just always expect our templates to just keep rendering and rendering and rendering. And if they do generate side effects, like the system can basically know not to keep firing those. So like an example, if you have like an async relationship in Ember Data and like you each post doc comments, and then the system just keeps re-rendering your template, it's not going to do a network request for every re-render. There's right. going to be one network request for the first render. And so like we have a good system in Ember for having this. And I guess in React, like these hooks give you, they give you those guarantees. You get to write a pure component. You don't have to think about how it's rendered. But you get to introduce state and mutation and all that stuff.
Yep. Cool. Good summary. Another one of the main motivations was basically removing the notion of this from the programming model. So in React, as in an Ember, we have stateful components. So it's like an instance of a class, and instances have state. You can like new up a person and give it a first name, and like you can pass that object around in its state. Components are the same thing. They're stateful objects. That's why we have methods on components that have like this dot first name, like full name is computed property returns this dot first name plus this dot last name. So your mental model is that this thing is like a state bag that's being passed around or rendered or whatever. And so in React with hooks now, the idea was that they saw folks getting tripped up on this argument. Also in React, you have to manually bind this to your action handlers. In Ember, we don't because of the action helper, but that's another thing you have to know and work around. It's just by design of the language. So this idea of algebraic effects is how can we emulate stateful objects and stateful mutations and side effects with just using an API that looks like pure functions. And so they've managed to do it in a way that removes this argument completely from the programming model, and you only interact with free variables. So basically like, let first name, new person with a first name of Sam, let user equal that. And then, you know, your handler does update user and you just do like user.
You get a function back.
You get a function back to mutate.
So you get a free variable and then a function to mutate that free variable.
Right. And behind the scenes, basically React is able to bind that function to that variable. But you, as a programmer, don't have to think about it.
Super cool.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's very elegant. Very elegant solution to that problem. So there's two interesting things about it. Well, basically, you can talk about it from two angles. One is what you as a developer get from the implementation side. So if I'm going to... author a hook that's going to let me do something that typically I would do. So in the talk, by the way, it's definitely worth any UI developer today watching Sophie and Dan's intro talk at ReactConf about this, because yeah, it's just, it's like they're at the forefront of UI development right now, and it's just awesome work that the React team is doing. Typically they kind of do it before and after. Before, you have a component with hooks like component did mount, component will unmount, similar to our did insert element, will destroy element. And we've all done things like setting up event handlers or setting up state and like adding actions on those stateful components and those methods. And now with hooks, you can do it all in a function, and you just have several functions that use these like state hooks and effect hooks, and you can reproduce that behavior using just functions. So from the authoring perspective, it's a different experience, right? You're avoiding this context, you're not binding this, and you're just writing functions that use these state free state variables and the updater functions that get returned by the hooks. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of cool. It's really cool from that perspective. Just from like, what is it like to actually work with this? It's like, you kind of think about it differently too. We were playing with it on Code Sandbox, which is an amazing tool, by the way, and which is getting Ember support really soon, which is awesome because it's just like a link and it has a whole environment set up.
Dude, it was unbelievable. Like, I'm a tangent.
Yeah.
But it was unbelievable that we just pulled up a Code Sandbox with a React environment and started coding.
Yeah.
There was no NPM.
It had prettier. I was doing it this morning. It was like a more pleasant environment than my daily coding environment, because I was like doing stuff and like prettier was automatically working. I've just never taken the time to do that. It made me want to do a coding environment all time in the browser. It made me want that to be my full-time environment. Nice. There's just so many little things. The console's right here. I mean, it's a UI for development. It's like the whole thing. I'm like, this is definitely like, I think this is the future for sure.
Yeah.
Give me an iPad Pro, max that sucker out, throw it up, maybe get me a couple of those. I'll have my editor and a browser right here. I mean, that's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Also, just it's like in the cloud. It's in the cloud. So
it's what you do.
I trust it. Yeah. It's in the cloud because, you know, that's how you do it these days. So anyways, back to the discussion. The authoring perspective is just, that's a difference in ergonomics and like affordance and all those things. Like, it just feels different.
Well, also on the authoring side too, is folks can use whatever you write. They can import it.
Well, that's the consumption side, which is what I was going to talk about next.
Okay.
So if you're
I'm thinking of that from an authoring side.
Well, if you're authoring a component, like let's say they talk about like a window width thing, and the way you would implement that and author that window width component or network status component as a declarative component, and you would use a component did mount, start listening for changes on the, you know, Windows network status, component will unmount, remove that listener, and then you'll have some local state on that component that's like network status is connected, true or false. And then you can like yield it. But now the way you author it is like use effect and you write a function and then you return the function that's like the cleaning up, and then you use state to like do that. So that's like, it just feels differently. Mm-hmm. But the cool thing on the consumption side, and what I mean by that is just like, now you've given me a network status component. How am I going to consume it? It enables a pattern of composition that was not possible with just components.
Let's talk about before this, what were the patterns of composition?
Yep. So as we've kind of been talking about this year a lot, we've been doing like renderless components more and more. And it started with, you know, contextual components are like superpower of Ember. And once you realize that you can yield out things like data or actions and not necessarily render HTML, you realize that this enables new composition methods that you were previously not able to do. So we just had a free video on an aspect ratio component that does render some stuff, but that's an example of composition. That's actually a perfect example where we pulled out this behavior of rendering something in a fixed aspect ratio into a component. So it lets you compose with your UI. But then there's other things like a network status component that would say network status as connected is connected. And now you can render that in Ember, let's say, with a contextual component. And any child of that can use the is connected yielded variable as a dynamic variable that will re-render when the network status changes. And so that composes well, because in any template, I can just drop in network status and get that. And it's amazing.
Potential downside is that you have a tree now. So you have network status and then, you know, indentation and the rest of your template. So if you had 5 or 6 of these components mixed with HTML, you'd have a whole bunch of indentation and you're not sure which of this is indentation for data sake versus which of this is indentation for UI and HTML sake.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, we actually had, when I was watching this Hooks talk, I was thinking, because we had a podcast about this where we, I don't remember where it was, but we were talking about there are things that aren't naturally suited for a hierarchical composition pattern, a method of composition as a hierarchy. Some things are perfect for it. Some things that you actually want, that's the desirable way to compose. Especially things that map to HTML, because HTML is a tree. So you have something like our UI form that you're going through in the current series, and it yields out these inputs. It makes total sense. It maps perfectly to what you'd expect. But then there's things where it doesn't. And it's interesting because the React community felt, so we feel this pain in Ember to some extent when you start making more of these compositional renderless components and you use them, and then you realize like, oh wait, these things are like just, yeah, they're adding hierarchical structure where it doesn't make sense. Even the providers we've been talking about recently.
Well, I actually have a good example of this where I had a provider, and the next line was a form. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I wrote the form, then I closed the form and I closed a provider. And then I needed some error message on the other side of the screen. There was like a flex box.
Yep.
And I needed to move an error message that came from the provider just into the next column.
Yep.
And so I kind of was like, okay, so like, yeah, I have to move where that provider gets closed. And that also means I have to move where it gets open because there's a bunch of divs. And it took what, like 10 seconds to do this, but it was still kind of like, okay, where do I move this thing to? And really, I don't need, the provider doesn't need to wrap anything.
Right.
When I'm looking at my template, the top line is just, should just be, like, I need this thing.
Yes.
I need this provider.
You do want the provider scope to the current component. You don't want it to just be a global thing. So in some sense, you want its children. You want to say, like, my children have access to this. But does it need to be such a granular thing that it's representing the tree structure? And the answer is maybe not, right? Maybe the provider, if it's just providing, like, actions and data, you could imagine, like, the provider just being a function that you knew up in, like, did insert element, and then you set like the actions on some data.
Well, I mean, this would be bad ergonomics, but you could imagine the provider being a mixin.
Yes, exactly. Yep, exactly.
And that's a good segue. Mixins are another method of composition that we have.
Exactly.
So you can take a component and you can apply a mixin to it, and that can set up the component with a whole bunch of data.
It can have event handlers. It can add state and remove state. Yep.
But what are some problems with?
Some problems with mixins that Ember community and React community experienced are there's like one namespace in your component. Every time you add mixin, you don't really know what's happening. I think that's one of the main problems. It's not actually encapsulated.
There's only so many underscore info variables that you can have.
Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, the one that always gets me is this.super.
Yep.
It's you add, you know, three or four mixins and you forget this.super and you're just, oof,
exactly,
world apart.
Yep. So this is why the hooks coming back with basically just being free variables is great, because you're not getting confused about this stuff. Just to step back to this idea of hierarchical composition, we experience that pain that we just talked through in Ember to some extent. The interesting thing is that in React, they experienced it much more acutely because first, they don't have the as keyword. So if you have a network status component in Ember, you do network status as is connected, and it's one level, and you get one level of nesting. Not too bad. One level of nesting. Not too bad. Have four components, you have four levels of nesting. Not too bad. In React, with the render props pattern, which is essentially yield contextual components in Ember, you get eight because of the way it works. The component is top level, and the child is a function that accepts the yielded property. And so the way it looks is it actually adds a lot of nesting. And this is the same with higher order components as well, which is another pattern of solves the composition case in the same way that render props does. Render props has been getting more popular, but both of them have the same idea. So you look at the React tree of an app and you just see like theme provider, context provider, form provider, but boom, 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 all the way down. And the UI doesn't resemble anything what the HTML structure does.
I have a question. React, if you make a higher order component that accepts, you have a higher order component called like H and it accepts component A.
Yeah, like with mouse position or something like that.
Yeah. When you look at in the React inspector, do you see two components there?
I think so.
Yeah. So then every higher component. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
So that seems bad.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, it doesn't seem. Sorry. I don't.
Yeah.
I'm not making fun of React. I'm saying it seems bad
from a debugging
point of view.
Yes. Yes. And back to, again, I think that podcast that we had talked about this, it's like insuitable as a mapping of how the programming model is in the programmer's mind. So I find that interesting because I think because they felt that pain more viscerally, they wanted to find something. They weren't going to put up with it as long, right? And all these other problems, but that's like one of the main things is like the nesting and this context. So methods of composition, we have nesting and yields, which is equivalent of like render props or basically higher order components as well. And then you have mixins. Mixins are in a sense more composable than like yielded components because you can take I can take my like user form and mix in like, you know, validatable, or I can mix in all these things to my user form, and my user form can become all of these things as opposed to like, it being a child of this. So that's when we say that composable, that's what we mean. And when they're talking about, we want to make things more composable is kind of what you're talking about. In the same way that, we've talked about element modifiers, how those are more composable because now I can just take an anchor tag and I can do animatable and trackable, an event trackable without having to do two things. It's like, it's composable. I'm just composing these things together and it's not like F of G of X. It's just like, it's like all at the same level instead of a hierarchy. So with hooks, it's like this really composable pattern because in the top of a function component, you can just call with network status or use network status, use window width, use, Ajax service, and you're just in the body of a function. So you just get to call as many as you want. There's no hierarchy. There's no limitations there at all. So it's pretty awesome. So that's like one of the main goals. You now have this like ultra composable way to build your components.
Yeah.
That manages to get rid of the class components and manages to get rid of the this argument and lets you work as if you're working with pure functions and free variables.
Yeah.
It's a pretty incredible design. Apparently it's borrowed from a lot of things, but one of the main influences is this thing called algebraic effects from some functional programming languages. Be interesting to read more about that, but I think that's where some of these ideas come from, which makes sense, right? Like functional programming languages are all about pure functions and
yep.
That's the idea. Now right behind the scenes that we had talked about like the implementation and we went and read about it. And there's like this kind of, there's global mutable state that is being shared, in order for React to treat these things as pure. Basically it just sees a component, renders it, and it keeps track. You're rendering this component. It sees a hook, you render it. And it's like, okay, we've got this hook, which is going to create some state. It's like a state bag, like we were talking about before. And this state bag goes with this component.
Because this is a currently rendered component.
Yes. Because we're here in the array of components that are being rendered. And then you go to render another component and you're going to boop here. And then we're going to call that hook again. And we're going to give you a new slot for that. And then that thing is just managed over the life cycle of your program. And whenever you start rendering this component again, which React knows because it's the one responsible for calling the render method to begin with, it's going to say, okay, you're calling this and you're calling the first thing, your first hook. I know it corresponds with this old hook. So we're going to update that state, which is basically like calling set state or calling set in Ember, which is going to trigger the re-render. So
it's really like scary how that works. Like but it's amazing. It's one of those things where it's like, if you delegate it to like the framework, it can provide such an awesome experience.
Yes.
But where like, if you wrote code like that, like what is a currently rendering component?
Yes.
And then I'm going to just have this giant global mutable state bag that I shove stuff into based on the current rendered component.
Like, seems error prone.
Yeah. I would not want that in like user land or app land.
It could seem so easy for it to just, oh, you missed a thing. You know, this is why they talk about like,
or like, I could imagine you get to a point where you're just like, oh, component that's like way down at the bottom of the tree needs to reach up into another component.
Yeah,
it's exactly. Like, hey, I have access to it. There's just a
global state,
global mutable array of all the states.
Right. yeah. And they talk about, that's why like the order of your hooks is always going to have to be the same. And you can't use like, if time of day is noon, run this hook, because now if you just think about the implementation, it makes sense.
Right. If your component has three hooks, it always has to have three hooks. Right. You can't do like an if else.
Right.
Because you could potentially get back
the wrong state.
The wrong hook.
Right.
The wrong state.
Right. Right.
And they one thing I like when we talk about like how you release features, they have a linting rule.
Yeah.
That makes sure you can't do this.
Yep.
And so it is nice that it's not just don't do this, it's gonna be cause errors, but here's also a linting rule to help you out.
Right.
Little things.
Yep, definitely. So that was really cool, and it definitely is like thought provoking. I encourage everyone to take a look at it because it's really good to think about. Just like the renderless components and yields give us new ways to think about how to share code in our own apps in Ember, I think this is going to give us some new ways to think about it as well. And you could see something coming to Ember one day that solves the same problem, maybe not in the same way, but we were playing around with it. And again, like there's these two sides from my perspective, the consumption and the authoring side. The authoring side is actually not as interesting to me as the consumption side, because the consumption side, you need to use the mouse position. Now you can just import mouse position from npm, use mouse position, and then you can just write like position.x in your template and that's it. And like, again, we can do that today with Ember in a very good way. You can make a declarative mouse position component, you can implement it great, and you can yield out the current mouse position, and it works beautifully. It's just that nesting. It's just the ergonomics of that nesting stuff that's kind of a bother. So on the authoring side, I actually like using a class and using this arguments. To me, that stuff doesn't really bother me. I don't think we get tripped up as much by that. Also, I think the action helper in Ember is another one. Both the action helper in Ember and the built-in yields means that we feel the pain less acutely than they do.
We've never had to think about this.
Never had to think about this.
Yeah.
Doesn't trip up people. I mean, unless you're starting to do advanced stuff, but the vanilla happy path experience with Ember, you should not really have to think about this at all.
Yep.
And it's nice, in my opinion, to have a class just because, you know, we have OOP backgrounds, that you have a function that you're working with and you just extract it to a method and you just call this dot add to do, pass in a to do. I like that.
I will. The thing that interests me most in it, I think this does fall on the authoring side, but again, it's that you can provide a function, a quote pure function,
right,
and not have to, the person doesn't have to, you don't have to give like setup instructions. You don't have to like say like, oh, mix this thing in, and if you have your own did insert element, make sure you call this dot super.
Right.
So I do like,
well, that's a benefit over mixins, but you don't have to give instructions if I gave you a with mouse position.
Okay.
It fits in more places than just the component does. You know, you can use a component in template, but you can't use it in your like lifecycle methods. How would you? If you needed to use the component width, if you need to use the window width in your lifecycle methods, did insert element, how would you do that? Like maybe you render the window width and then you bind it to like a state variable.
And you pass it in.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that, right?
No, I mean, what I would do if I was writing this, what I would do is I would have like a service as well as a component, and they would probably share data. But if you needed it in JavaScript land, you could inject a service.
And that's why... But the hooks now, are powerful,
right? Because
you can use them in both places.
Yeah,
pretty awesome.
Pretty good. Yeah.
So that's why the consumption side I think is the most interesting. It's like you now have one way to do this stuff. One way to consume it. Like, yeah, you have a window, use window with a hook, and I can use it. I can render it in my component. It's all declarative, etc. The authoring side, it almost actually feels like another language, because if you look at like Rich Harris from Svelte and Evan from Vue, they're experimenting with bringing this idea, the algebraic effects, to their languages, to their frameworks. And Rich Harris was doing something where, because he has a compiler, Svelte is all compile time. You can say like x equals 2, y equals x time, x squared. And then in your template, you render y. And then... you have a button that does X plus plus, and you just click on it, and then Y is just being updated. It's almost like a new language. If you were writing Excel, you would just say equals A1 times 2. You're writing a formula, but in your mind, you know that that's like a live bound formula. In JavaScript, it's not normally, but you could imagine like the Svelte API basically makes it that way. And that's almost what you're doing here, because when you write a function component with hooks, it's getting run over and over and over again. Just like, yeah, you're in Excel, you're like, oh yeah, I know. Like I write equals A1 times two, and I know it's going to get run over and over again every time A1 changes.
Yep.
So it's really interesting. It makes me think there is what you really want here when you're a UI programmer building like a reactive app is like, you want these to be your primitives. Like you want it to be like this notion of reactivity all the time.
Yeah.
And you want to just declare what the thing is as a derived value of these other things.
By the way, you want that like all the way up the stack.
All the way. Yes.
So when like a database row changes, it just boom, all the way down to the UI.
Exactly. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about that too. Like it's so fast in Excel. You just like click on a cell, you have a reference to it, and then you just write something else as a derived function of that cell. I think like UI programming could be there one day where like you're in a visual editor and you're just like clicking something and then like saying it's equal to this, but the references are taken care of for you. Like I also think hooks are really powerful because they're so low level. This is something React's done a really good job of. The high level stuff, you know, again, like the action helper is really great in Ember and the yields are really great in Ember. But when it comes to like low level things where you can make your own stuff at that level, it's not so easy. Like it's not, there's like high level things, but there's not a lot of low level things.
Yeah.
And with React, the low level stuff is very powerful. And it made me think like, yeah, this visual environment that I'm kind of talking about, you think of like, if you've ever used any of the Microsoft programs where you just have like a database grid and you drag a database table on it, like super powerful, but they don't decompose at all. So you run into walls all the time. I feel like with these low level things that the community is building up, eventually you could get to a better spot where you have the escape hatches, it decomposes and you don't get locked in. But I really do believe like that's just stuff like hooks shows us that we don't need as much power as we think we do. We don't need the full expression of like full programming languages to do most of what we need to do, right?
And there's huge benefits.
Yes.
Huge benefits.
Yes. Yes. Just like in Excel, making like a reactive thing is like extremely easy. It's much more limited than a programming language, but I can make four reactive cells much easier than you can in React app or Ember app.
Right.
Like I can make it in 2 seconds.
Yep.
And if that's the kind of thing you're building, there's a tool out there that can do a better job at that as an authorship tool. So pretty interesting stuff. It would be cool to think about, play around with some APIs for what this could look like. We were talking about it where basically I think the first step would be like, how can you avoid having to nest in a handlebars template? How could you do it where you could like declare at the top with window width as width or something like that?
I think there were the let helper RFC covered some of this. I think it was out of scope.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you could define a free variable mm-hmm. with let
that gives itself access to
the context template, whatever you call it. I know you were playing around with some stuff
mm-hmm.
to do this.
Mm-hmm. Window width as width with a nesting is how you would normally do it with a renderless component. You could imagine like putting like with window width at the top or window width as a top, and then like basically like on window width change mute current width, and then now the whole template gets it, but you don't have to nest it.
Yeah, so you have a action that mutes.
Yeah, callback. That's like it's like refs. How refs work in React as well. Like you need a reference to the thing, wait until it renders, and then you have a reference to it. It's like you're getting a reference to the window width. But this is like Excel. If you think about it, you're like getting I need a reference to A1, so I'm just gonna say equals A1 times two. You kind of want that. You kind of want like window width reference the current width. User form provider reference like the current user and like the sign in action. And then like you can just do that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting because we don't get to just use new primitives that are function calls because templates are not JavaScript by choice. But I also think there is a possible future where there's maybe an extension of the language or something that really is a natural fit suitable for this kind of declarative reactive formula type thing. It could be really cool. But I would be most excited if I had to choose one thing that I wanted from the hook stuff is amazing. It's awesome. If there's one thing I would want from it in Ember, it would be the composition patterns, like the ability to just I get like a window width component and then I can just grab it very easily, both in my template and in my JavaScript ideally. But I don't have to nest it. And it's just easier that way. So pretty interesting stuff.
Do you see there just being way less renderless components now in the React ecosystem because of these hooks?
I guess if you have a window width, if you have a use window width hook, yeah, I guess it's not a component, even though it's not a component, kind of is, but it's a hook. It's a hook that gets run. It's basically a function that can get run over and over again and always be up to date. I don't think, first of all, the hooks are like alpha or whatever. As Dan Abramov keeps telling everybody on Twitter, they're like, you know, they're not released, but it seems like that's the direction they want to go. I do think renderless components make sense in a lot of cases. But yeah, I think if you look at that stuff, the use window width, being able to just call that and use it anywhere, I think it's just easier. I think at the end of the day, and we were talking about this a little bit, if something is just so drastically easier to use, then it's going to get used.
Yeah.
Which is not always the best thing, but a lot of times it is. A lot of times it is. How jQuery got used, how React got used at the beginning, they're very easy to use. It's easy to get your job done. You're in Rails and you need to like open the form and I can just $myform.slideDown. That's super easy. I'm going to do that. So I think we, from those easy to use APIs, we get the kind of correct higher level APIs. And I think that's what we're going to see with hooks. So I think if you tell me I need the current size of my component and, I can just import component size and use component size, and now I have it, I'm going to do that because there's nothing easier probably.
Yeah.
So I think we'll see that a lot.
Cool.
But it'll be really interesting to see how things shake out.
Yeah.
So worth keeping an eye on for sure.
I mean, I don't know what it's going to look like. I know it's going to be amazing.
Yes.
There's going to be some like mind-bending,
yes,
really cool stuff.
Yes. It's exciting to be a JavaScript developer for sure, because all this stuff is just... It's like a rising tide lifts all ships or whatever, you know. Yeah. Pretty cool stuff. So yeah, definitely check that talk out. We'll put a link to it in the show notes for sure. Worth watching. And then Ryan Florence had a follow up where he just gets to kind of go crazy and like hacks on this stuff. It's called 90% Better React, and it's interesting because you see some of the API concessions that were made to enable this. And again, this is where I think like, yep, there's going to be some high level stuff that we see in the coming year or two that's going to be like crystallize it.
Yes.
Whereas, yep, right now it's like, it's very clear. This is a very low level thing.
I liked his talk. It was great to just see all the different situations you can, it helped crystallize this for me.
Right.
So yeah.
Worth watching.
Yeah, definitely.
We'll link that as well.
So where can folks find more?
So if you want to find the show notes for this episode, go to emmermap.com. The newest podcast episode will be up there. And if you like the show and you want to help other people find it, we'd appreciate a review on iTunes. That's the best way to help new folks discover the show. So other than that, thanks a lot for joining us, and we'll see you next week.
See ya.